This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Will I get it? How can I prevent getting it? What can we do for somebody who has it? Those are among the most frequent questions experts on Alzheimer's hear from the general public. Whether those are your questions or there's something else about dementia you'd like to know, this would be the hour to ask. With us, a neuropsychologist who both researches the disease and treats patients who have it, plus the leader of a Virginia agency that advocates for patients and their families, and an author whose latest book, filled with beautiful photographs, was originally designed for his mom, but just might also be of help to many thousands of others. An update on Alzheimer's is our focus. The conversation begins right after the news. I'm Tom Graham. Great to be with you. And this is Virginia Insight. Alzheimer's is our focus today. And if you've got a question about it or a story to share, I hope you will join us at 888-WMRA-TALK. We are coming to you this hour from the studios of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, but you can contact us the same as always, 888-967-2825. A little bit later, we will hear from a former Charlottesville area man who decided to help his aging mother with a book. Now, he's an author, so that might not be a big surprise, but his new photograph-laden volume and how it is being used certainly could be. First, however, two people who've spent much of their careers working to help patients with dementia and their families. Dr. Kathleen Fuchs is a neuropsychologist as well as a member of the Memory and Aging Care Division at the University of Virginia. Sue Friedman is president and CEO of the Alzheimer's Association of Central and Western Virginia. Thank you both for making time for us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
Well, Dr. Fuchs, to you first, if I could, let's get right to those three so frequently asked questions noted at the top of the hour. When somebody, for example, says to you, am I going to get Alzheimer's, what do you say to them?
I say, I don't know. But I say, there are some things that you can do to lessen your risk of this. And then pretty much after that, we jump into a conversation, which is the question that precedes, am I going to get Alzheimer's? And that is, what is the difference between Alzheimer's disease and dementia? Because a lot of people use these two terms synonymously, and they're a little bit different. And for your listeners, I'll just explain. To think of the word dementia as like an umbrella term, it covers a lot of different disease processes. The one we know most and is most prevalent is Alzheimer's disease. So when we say Alzheimer's, we're talking about a specific cause for what is a dementia syndrome. And what dementia means is a decline from somebody's general regular level of functioning to a degree that they start to not be able to do the things they should be able to do. And it can start off with difficulty doing more complex tasks like filing your income taxes, which most of us hopefully have done or are doing right about now, or cooking meals and driving places, to all the way down to more simple things like getting dressed properly. So when somebody slides down to the level where they need help with these things that they could normally do, we say they probably have a dementia syndrome, and one of the reasons why they might could be because the changes in the brain represent what we call Alzheimer's pathology. So that's sort of an indirect way of asking or answering your question. But typically we say if you want to avoid getting this, there are some things that you can do, such as keeping yourself very healthy and active.
That's so true, Dr. Fuchs, and we always appreciate you when you are able to join with the Alzheimer's Association in educational programming. And we encourage people to remember that heart healthy is brain healthy, and that physical activity is the one thing that we now know through research has been proven to help avoid, to the extent that we can avoid, help delay, to the extent that we can delay, Alzheimer's disease. We also encourage people to continue to learn, especially new things. If you've never danced, learn to dance. If you don't know a second language, learn a second language. And lastly, we encourage people to continue interacting with other human beings. Social interaction is really critical to the good interworkings of the brain. Consider it as if it's oil for the brain in many ways. And that social interaction, the art of conversation, what we're doing right now today, is very beneficial to the brain.
Yeah, I think people don't realize, Sue, how much work it takes to have a conversation with somebody.
You're so correct.
Yeah, people don't appreciate that's actually good exercise because you are anticipating what the person is saying, following their reasoning, thinking of your own things. It's a lot of multitasking in your head just to have a conversation.
Well, we try to simplify all the science. And we say it's like switching gears in your car. You're encouraging your brain to move here, there, grasp that, put these things together, and come out with words. And then also your ears have to be listening. So you're exactly correct that social interaction is really critical, especially as our parents and grandparents get older and oftentimes are left living alone.
Yeah.
That's not a good situation.
Yeah.
Leader of the Alzheimer's Association for Central and Western Virginia, Sue Friedman, and University of Virginia neuropsychologist Kathleen Fuchs are our guests. Alzheimer's, as well as other forms of dementia, our focus. If you want to join the conversation, we've got a phone line open for you at 888-WMRA-TALK. In all numbers, that's 888-967-2825. Kathleen and Sue, I want to get back to those other two most commonly asked questions, but we've already got this post on our Facebook page from Katrina, which Sue, probably her question should go to you first. Katrina's saying, quote, "We've been told by doctors that my mother-in-law, who has dementia, will likely need to move into an assisted living facility within the next 6 to 12 months. However, neither she nor any of the family have the resources for this level of care. Does the state provide any support for dementia care? And what are some of the resources for identifying the right assisted living facility?"
Well, great questions. And first of all, the state does not specifically provide resources for long-term care facility care. There is what's called a waiver program. There is also, of course, Medicaid, which is a federal program. It's available here in the state of Virginia. Our experience has been that any long-term care facility, any social worker will know the ins and outs of how to investigate what is appropriate for that family and that individual's financial situation. The second question is a very, very important one, and I would direct you to two resources. ALZ.org has a very good care finder and caregiver component of the website with things like a checklist. What are the questions I need to ask of a long-term care facility to make sure that they're going to provide the kind of care my mother or mother-in-law needs? We also have resource lists that are available so that all the facilities in a particular geographic area, we have their names, addresses, and phone numbers. And we also are able to identify if they have a dementia or a memory care unit, which is a very specialized service that's often offered, but not all the time. So those would be important things to look into and important questions to ask. And I know, Dr. Fuchs, in your practice, you have this question probably weekly.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And the interesting thing, the a person who posed the question said that they were told within the next 6 to 12 months. And I tell you, the question I often get from family members is, how soon? How fast is this going to go? When am I going to need this? When am I going to need that? And it's so hard to make blanket statements about that because the course is so individual. A lot of people kind of slowly go downhill, but we find that when they're in their normal, familiar surroundings doing their routine activities, they do fairly well. They may need some prompts or reminders or another adult present, but they can be in their own home with that sort of supervisory level of care. But when people start to exhibit behavioral symptoms such that they're doing things that are impulsive or unsafe, or they're having other significant physical problems like they're falling to the extent that they would need 24-hour care and kind of eyes-on supervision, that's when we say it might be time to have somebody move to an assisted living facility or a nursing care facility because the needs for an individual family to meet are just too great.
Could we go back to the money part of Katrina's question for a moment? Basically, she's saying what I'm sure lots of people worry about when there's a relative who seems to be showing signs of dementia. The thought comes up, I'm sure, how are we going to pay the medical bills? And if they have to go into a nursing home, how could we possibly afford that? Are there ways that Katrina can get more information about what kind of help is available?
There are. Department of Social Services is a great stop in terms of getting information. And again, any long-term care facility is going to have admissions folks and social workers who are there.
Let me make sure I understand you, Sue Friedman. When you say Department of Social Services, that's a local county agency?
Yes.
As opposed to the National Social Security?
No. Okay. No. Social Services is local. Oftentimes what happens, and having had this situation with family members, and I'm sure many of our listeners, as the resources for our senior citizens dwindle, they become in need of assistance. Oftentimes that assistance is the Medicaid program. Medicare is an insurance program, a dental vision insurance program for all senior citizens. Medicaid is a program for those who don't have the financial resources but still need services, whatever they may be. So oftentimes it's looking at the ramifications and the opportunities around becoming Medicaid eligible. All AAAs, Area Agency on Aging's, whether it's VPass over in the Valley or the JABA here in the Charlottesville Thomas Jefferson District, have specialists who help families navigate the world of Medicaid eligibility.
To you on the other side of your radio, how much do you worry about someday being diagnosed with Alzheimer's or some other form of dementia? Are there things that you've begun to purposefully do to keep your mind sharp for as long as possible? 888-WMRA-TALK is our number. That's 888-967-2825. Or you can choose the Facebook route, as Katrina did. We're listed on Facebook as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Katrina, thank you so very much for those great questions. Dr. Kathleen Fuchs, let's go back to this original question. A subset of that first question, I think, would be, tell us more about what Alzheimer's is. Most of us have heard that it involves plaque on the brain, but is that even right? And what else is important to know?
Right. So the basic pathology of Alzheimer's disease is what we call plaques and tangles. And basically these are formed when there's an abnormal protein cleavage in the brain that kind of creates debris or junk, if you will, in the brain. And, we could be a lot more technical, but it sort of doesn't move us forward. But
well, just help me understand what a protein cleavage is, because I want to imagine that in my mind. Does that mean a protein cuts itself in half or something?
Well, there are certain genes that tell, various cells what to do, and our bodies are continually making things, and they're making proteins, and certain genes say, okay, make a protein this long, and another gene is going to say, we're going to fold it in this way so it can have this purpose, and so on. But when the master programming, if you will, goes awry, that protein may get cut off too soon, may get cut off too late, such that it can't serve its normal purpose. And then, as I said, if you think about it, it's like just junk clogs up in the brain. And I mean, that's kind of a gross analogy. But slowly but surely what happens is that this accumulates and causes cells to die off. And we see that in the brain when we do an MRI. People may be told that their brain is showing some signs of atrophy when they do neuroimaging. And that's a fancy way of saying shrinkage. So there's tissue loss there. There's more fluid in the spaces, less tissue doing what it should do. Connections get lost and so on. And we know from Alzheimer's that this process starts in certain parts of the brain that are very important for consolidating new memories. So making or laying down new memories and then retrieving them later on. So that's why one of the early stages of Alzheimer's disease is that memory loss of recently presented information.
I'm reasonably sure you listening have questions about the topic of Alzheimer's or dementia. We've got phone lines open at 888-WMRA-TALK, but as you can probably tell from the music, we do have to pause for a break. When we get back from the break, we have this fascinating man. Well, Actually, I don't know if he's fascinating, but his new book is amazing. So we're going to talk to him about that. It is related to his mom's experience with Alzheimer's. We continue in about 1 minute. So somewhere in our audience right now is someone who's had extensive experience with an Alzheimer's patient. Maybe someone in your own family who contracted the disorder. If you are that person and you're willing to share some of your experience, 888-WMRA-TALK is how to reach us by phone. That's 888-967-2825. Or you can post a question or comment through our Facebook page where we're listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Speaking of having a story to tell, well, joining us now is the author who created this unusual new book. I say created because wrote the book might not be exactly accurate. It actually contains very little text. Instead, it's filled with beautiful color photographs, each titled with a short, easy-to-read caption. We understand the inspiration for this volume was our guest's mother, so we'll ask him to further describe the book and that inspiration. Eliezer Sobel. Thank you so very much for making time for us.
Thanks, Tom. I appreciate being here.
Tell us about your mom.
My mom is 89 years old, and she's in her 12th year of Alzheimer's. And my dad is 89 years old, and he's in his 12th year of keeping her home and taking care of her with a full team of aides coming in and out. So we were quite privileged that he had the necessary funds to keep her at home and have one-on-one care pretty much 24 hours a day, which was a blessing. To jump to how the book came about, because there were 12 years of stories that preceded this, but my mom's language went through an interesting process. One day I saw her standing in front of wet clothes in the laundry room in front of the washing machine. And I was nearby, and I heard her asking, "Which button do I push to make it dry?" Meaning she had forgotten that it was a separate machine called a dryer. A little further down the line, she stopped knowing where the laundry room was. And then after that, it was, well, what's a laundry room for? And eventually, she no longer understood the word laundry. And then the final step was she couldn't even say the word anymore. So my brother, who's a psychologist, explained to me that often people with dementia unlearn language in a similar reverse sequence as infants learn the language, which is by identifying objects within general categories. So we noticed my mom started calling the vacuum cleaner the machine, and she called the telephone the machine, and the camera and the car. They were all machines. But it indicated she had some recognition on some level that they were all mechanical objects. And then soon that devolved into what I've been told is called word salad, where she was still speaking English and you could tell she was having a thought and the intention to communicate. But about three or four words in, she would lose that intention and just go off in some sort of random direction. And I once transcribed one of them because it was so interesting, and I brought that with me. It was things she would do this every day. Things like, "Well, I have the pictures, and if someone doesn't come tomorrow, then there's nothing I can do. I'll have to tell someone to fix it. And I have the blue one and the red one." And then she would pick up a random scrap of paper and say, "Well, here it says call Irving, but I can't really help those people." So it was still English, but then gradually the English disappeared, and my mom came up with her own language, her own gibberish language of nonsensical words, but yet she remained very engaged. So we would have very long conversations, making eye contact, feeling our connection, but it was things like she would say, "I don't have the pendle and I can't make a calendalish." And I would just improvise, "Really? We're not going to have a calendalish?" "Oh, you too? Well, I'll buy an aerospate because they are too Bach. And the Feliternosti has to be ironed, and you can get rid of your Vindermint," things like this. And then there were less English and less English in between until it was all nonsense. But she remained engaged. So I always felt connected to my mom throughout 12 years. And I always was amused, not amused is the right word, but interested, because one of the most common questions my friends would ask me, and it would always be with this forlorn look on their face, like they were afraid to ask, and they would say, "Does your mom still know who you are?" As if that was the most important thing. And I would think to myself inside my mind, well, I don't really know who I am. Why should I care if she knows who I am? Because the truth was, even if she didn't know my name and didn't know I was her son, or that she had children or had been married 67 years, the feeling, the emotional feeling of connection on a soul level never went away. And I realized over time that was all that was important to me. So if I walked into the room and she lit up and smiled, that felt enough to me. I didn't need her to know the content of our relationship. How
Sue Friedman, as we've been listening to Eliezer's story, I've noticed out of the corner of my eye that you're nodding your head and smiling a lot.
One of the things we know well in our world, where we have programs and services to support people with Alzheimer's and their caregivers, is one of the very last things that goes is the appreciation of all arts, whatever they may be, and the ability to engage in those arts and creative expression and the emotion. And so we help families learn how to talk Alzheimer's, if you will. And the word salad is absolutely what we call that. And to help people understand that it's not the context, it's the connection. And in fact, I have a coworker, Ellen Phipps, who is a certified therapeutic recreation specialist, who wrote a book, and we self-published it. And it is actually a toolkit to re-engage people dealing with Alzheimer's or dementia in meaningful quality of life activities, so that that connection is there. Either it's reinstated or it's maintained. So we know this very well, and really encourage families to not dwell on "they don't know me," but still dwell on what we call the cognitive benefits they still have, and to maximize those to the greatest extent possible.
Eliezer Sobel's new book is titled Blue Sky, White Clouds, a book for memory-challenged adults. Sue Friedman is president and CEO of the Alzheimer's Association for Central and Western Virginia. With us by phone, neuropsychologist Kathleen Fuchs, a member of the Memory and Aging Care Division at the University of Virginia. Eliezer, it's my understanding that one of the reasons we have this book in existence today is that something happened once when your mom was looking at a magazine.
Right. I had assumed for about 3 years that all of her conventional language and communication skills were gone forever. I hadn't heard English out of her, except in the rare moments something lucid would pop through for about 2 seconds. She once came up to me and said, "I'm glad I had you," out of the blue, which was amazing. But one day I walked into the living room and she had a magazine she was flipping through, and I heard her reading the headlines that were in big print out loud in English. And I was just floored, because I had no idea she had still had that capacity. And I thought, wow, Mom can still read. She can't read a sentence or a paragraph, but she can read a 3 or 4 word phrase. So I thought, well, this is great. I'll just go out to Barnes & Noble and buy a book that's written for Alzheimer's patients. And I went and I looked and I looked and I looked, and I didn't find one title. And so I came home and I looked on Amazon and other book sites on the internet, and I didn't find one title. So I called the National Alzheimer's Association and spoke to their librarian, and she knew of one or two titles that were written for the patient, and she knew of 20,000 titles written for caregivers. And I was just mind blown. How could this be that no one has addressed this population? So I ordered the one that she told me existed, and my mother loved it and read it 300 times. It was by Lydia Burdick. But it wasn't quite the book I had in mind, because I know my mother very well, and Lydia's book is beautiful, but it's illustrated in an animated way like a children's book, and my mom prefers very realistic photos of children, of babies, of old people, of mountains and streams and cows.
Most of the time, I'm really glad that this is radio, because it means I don't have to wear makeup anymore when I was doing television interviews. But this is one of those occasions where I really wish I could hold some of the pages of this book, Eliezer, up to the microphone and people could see them.
Tom,
ask Eliezer if he could just... This is the very first picture in your book. Would you describe that? Maybe people can create the picture in their mind and then tell us what it says underneath the picture.
Well, believe it or not, this first photo was taken by my ninth grade English teacher, and I'm 60 years old, so that's kind of interesting. It just shows a very beautiful, tiny bird, primarily yellow with some black feathers, sitting gently on someone's the palm of someone's hand, and with their other hand, looks like they're about to gently caress it. And the caption is simply a tiny yellow bird. And it's designed to require no memory in order to enjoy this page before you turn to the next page. You don't have to remember anything about the page. Each photo and caption is a world unto itself. And the people I've met seem to just... who have used it with their parents, just enjoy. They pick one or two photos that they really relate to, and they either read the caption or study the photo or touch the faces with their fingers. And it doesn't, they don't have to remember anything to enjoy the book. It's almost like a meditation. And it can also, if people are still speaking, it can stimulate reminiscence and stimulate conversation. And the main thing it does is create an opportunity for a very tender connection with their loved ones, just to have an activity to do together.
Eliezer Sobel, author of this new book, Blue Sky, White Cloud, I feel like I'm almost doing something evil at picking out specific pictures and asking you to describe them, because when I page through this book, what I see is not only beautiful color photographs, but each of them seem to radiate emotion. And sometimes the emotion is a sense of tranquility or peacefulness, but many of these photographs, like this one other one I want to ask you to describe, just radiate this incredible joy. So describe this one here and then tell us the caption, please.
I've never had to do this, by the way. This is a man wearing a jean shirt. And he's surrounded by two horses. One of them has their long head resting, leaning and resting from the behind on his left shoulder while he scratches the horse's cheek, if that's what it's called. The other horse is a little bit higher on the other side of him, and it seems to be licking his eye and forehead while he is joyfully laughing.
And he's got this huge smile.
Huge grin. He's obviously in bliss, and the caption is simply, "The two horses love the man." And I intentionally pause after I say that, because these are like little Zen meditations for even regular folks, not just Alzheimer's folks, or children. It's been used with children as their first reader.
Sue Friedman, do you remember what you were going to say a few minutes ago when I so rudely interrupted you?
Well, I was going to say that we are really thrilled that Eliezer is going to be with us in Harrisonburg at the Alzheimer's Workshop on June 13th.
You've seen this book before.
Yes. Oh, yes. Yes. And so
what do you think of it in terms of what he had intended, first for his mom and then for other Alzheimer's patients?
I think it absolutely makes perfect sense, because what we have always encouraged people to do is to go back through your photo albums and bring out pictures from your photo albums and just enjoy looking at those pictures and see what kinds of emotions and connections and peace and happiness and contentment that those pictures can generate for your loved one. And so this is a way of taking those pictures out, away from your photo album, but just pictures of life in general, and putting those together in a collection. the meaningful engagement is the key, and capitalizing on any cognitive strengths that are still there are absolutely keys. And I know, Dr. Fuchs, you have something to add.
I do. Thank you. You know, the thing I want to go back to is the beautiful story Eliezer was telling about how his mother's language declined. And what is so beautiful about that story is he went to where she was. So when she started creating her own language, she still had that drive to have a conversation, and he was willing to sit down and have that conversation in that language. And I think that's what I'm hearing is coming through in the book, is that he's been able to go where she is and help her be in that world. And the other thing you said a moment ago, each photo is a world unto itself. Absolutely. I think for a lot of folks with Alzheimer's, everything is so in the moment. It's right there. And when you turn the page, it's all different again. But you turn the page to something just as lovely.
By phone from the University of Virginia Medical Center, Dr. Kathleen Fuchs, here with me at the studios of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, advocate for Alzheimer's patients and their families, Sue Friedman, plus author, musician, composer, and as he describes it, lifelong spiritual seeker, Eliezer Sobel. These are our guests. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Dr. Fuchs, I have this whole list of questions that I wanted to ask you, but I need to pause here and ask first if there's something you most want to talk about before I get to my list.
Well, let's go to your list.
Okay. So we said at the outset that there are these three most often asked questions. The second one, and they were in no particular order, but the second one that we haven't discussed much yet is what can I do to prevent it? I know we talked a little bit about exercise and nutrition, doing the same as what you would do to keep your heart healthy, but is there more than that?
Well, yes and no. And I want to go back up to the exercise thing just for a minute, in that a lot of people think they have to go hit a gym every single day, multiple hours a day, in order for exercise to be of benefit. And what's been really exciting about the studies that have come out is that it doesn't need to be big, strenuous exercise. And in fact, I'm seeing, and Sue, you might agree with me on this, a move toward it's not just exercise, but also general activity. So the more
yes.
people are going out and doing and engaged, that kind of counts. But one of my favorite studies I often tell people about is one that just looked at people who walk. And what they found is folks who walked a minimum of, or about a maximum even, of 6 miles a week, that's not a lot over a week, over a period of time. And they looked at these folks for, I'm thinking it was about 10 years, that the folks who walked 6 miles or better a week showed better brain, not activity, but better brain volumes on MRI. So they weren't showing that atrophy or shrinkage as much. And they were doing much better on cognitive tests. So that's for folks who didn't at baseline have cognitive changes. But even for the people who at the start of the study had some cognitive decline or memory problems, if those people were out and walking, they did a lot better at the toward the end of the study than people who were less active. So it doesn't take a lot of activity. The other thing that people ask me about as they think about what can I do to prevent Alzheimer's is they ask, should I be playing computer games and doing those sorts of things? And maybe that's something that we can come back to in just a minute.
You're a pro at this. You heard the music. You knew that we only had a few moments before we're going to the break. So we are going to ask you more about that and also hear more from Eliezer Sobel about his experience, as well as Sue Friedman, President and CEO of the Alzheimer's Association for Central and Western Virginia. We continue in just a bit more than 1 minute. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Our focus this hour, Alzheimer's. Let's say that twice, three times. Our Alzheimer's, okay. Our Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia. My guest, the leader of the Alzheimer's Association for Central and Western Virginia, Sue Friedman, University of Virginia neuropsychologist and researcher, Kathleen Fuchs, as well as author Eliezer Sobel. Kathleen, more about how computer games are going to save my brain?
Okay. So So we mentioned exercise is good for you. Sue talked about heart-healthy diet, which is good for folks, and then also cognitive engagement or doing things that are intellectually challenging, learning new things. So a question I get asked all the time is, well, I see all these computer programs out there to train my brain. Should I plunk down the money and buy these things and do them? Or should I be doing lots of crossword puzzles and things? And my typical response is, well, do you like crossword puzzles? Do you like Sudoku puzzles? Do you like computer games? If you like them, they're fun. I say by all means do them. You will probably get better at doing them as you continue to do them. The one problem is that there isn't a lot of good sort of clinical trial type research to show that doing those things is better than something else. So I'm not sure for some of these programs that maybe cost a lot of money if it's cost effective. Like I said, you get better at doing the tasks contained within the program, but it doesn't seem to always translate out into real-world abilities.
And I know this is just anecdotal, but my uncle, my mom's younger brother, who's also been a Alzheimer's patient for 10 years, was a very sophisticated mathematics textbook writer. So that's way beyond crossword puzzles. He was doing, you know, fancy equations and calculus. So his brain was quite sharp, and it didn't seem to impact his getting Alzheimer's. But like I said, that's anecdotal. But what I wanted to know is I have read studies that although exercise is the best thing, as you've both said, for possible prevention, I've heard that within the category of exercise, free form dance, meaning not learning to do the Macarena or the Mambo, but actually free form dance where you just are creating steps as you go, is the most effective form of exercise because of the whatever it requires of the brain to be creating moment by moment by moment without any preconceived patterns to fit into. Have either of you heard about this?
No, and that doesn't mean that it doesn't exist, and that doesn't mean that it certainly wouldn't be beneficial and valuable, because you're really combining the movement, if you will, the exercise, with the kind of stimulation, the cognitive stimulation. So I certainly can see how it would be beneficial. So that may be something that eventually comes out, that there are certain kinds of exercise that are more valuable for the brain than others. But you look at art appreciation. I mean, viewing art versus making art versus singing art versus performing art. I don't know that the research has gotten so specific yet to differentiate any one of them is better than another. And what we say is all of them have value. And as Dr. Fuchs said, where does the personal interest lie? You know, that's a real key.
I agree about with what Sue said about the free form dance. It makes sense to me that that would be good because it engages a person in many, many different ways. And sort of like it sort of makes sense for some people. Like I said, the studies haven't showed that these computer games show a lot of effect in real world life. But what they can do for somebody is give them that sense that, hey, I can learn and do new things. And it gives them a sense of confidence, such as when they get out in their real world activities, they might kind of go with a little more gusto, if you will. They'll actually actively engage and try things and perhaps put out a little more effort. And then as they are more successful, they do better. So when people come back to me and said, hey, you know, I did try this computer game and I'm a lot better at things, I don't know if the game trained their brain or sort of, if you will, trained the attitude a little bit more. And let me just add one quick comment about, you said that I guess your mom's brother also was a mathematician and developed Alzheimer's.
Right.
Now, it may be that, yes, his very good mental activity didn't prevent him from getting Alzheimer's, but we don't know if it maybe delayed that onset because he had a lot of what we call cognitive reserve. So his brain was so nicely developed and connected and so on that he could have maybe withstood pathology longer than had he not had that nicely developed brain.
You know, Dr.
So I just want to mention that we've got something going on here. All my years of experience doing this kind of talk show, I can tell you for certain there are two things happening with the audience. One is you guys are so fascinating that people are afraid to interrupt, to call us at 888-WMRA-TALK. The second factor is we're actually discussing a fairly sensitive subject, and there are some things that people might ask if they weren't afraid of revealing themselves publicly. So I'm going to do that part for a question that I'm sure some people have. Kathleen, Dr. Fuchs, you made a reference early on to genetics. We're touching on things related to genetics now. So let me give you this about myself. I was adopted, but I happen to know a lot about my biological parents and their relatives. I know that my biological father, although he died fairly early from heart disease, he had three brothers and one sister, all who lived into their 80s or longer. Only one of whom developed Alzheimer's in his mid-80s and lived with it until his early 90s. On my biological mother's side, I know even more about all of her relatives, including her grandparents and her great uncles and great aunts, none of whom was ever diagnosed with Alzheimer's, all of whom lived at least until their 70s, some up until age 90. One person in that extended family history has Alzheimer's. Kathleen Fuchs, does that increase my chance of getting Alzheimer's?
Yeah, perhaps. Now, I'm hedging a little bit because this wasn't your direct parent. So you've got a lot of other genes in the mix there.
No, it was an uncle.
Right, right.
It was a paternal uncle.
Right, so it wasn't your first-degree relative. And the other factor is, as you said, this person didn't develop dementia until in their 80s. Is that right?
That's correct.
So if you had told me that this person developed this much, much sooner, I'd be a lot more worried. But in the 80s is sort of more a target range where we might expect to see this more without such a genetic load into it. Plus, again, you've inherited some genes from a side of the family that appeared to be pretty long-lived and pretty healthy. So you did a good job choosing your parents.
there's a whole hour. Did you say something about first-degree family?
Right.
Tell us a little bit more about closer genetic connections and what that might mean to somebody wondering if they have a genetic propensity.
Right. And so here's where Sue is going to correct me on some stats for a second.
I doubt that.
Well, so if you've got a first-degree relative, meaning like a parent or a sibling, your risk of having Alzheimer's disease or developing Alzheimer's disease is higher. I will say certainly the most close-degree relative you would have would be an identical twin. But interestingly, the concordance, or we use the word concordance, meaning if one twin gets Alzheimer's, then the other twin gets Alzheimer's, that is not 100%, even with somebody who shares your genes. So it's not all about your genes. Certainly that seems to confer some risk or, you know, that might interact with something in the environment or as you develop, as you get older, but it's not 100%. Most of us walking around, we've got a risk of developing Alzheimer's if we live long enough. Like I said, the main risk factor is age. But if you have a family where several members have Alzheimer's disease, even if they're not your first-degree relatives, and this seems to hit them early, like in their early 60s, that's somewhat more concerning to us when somebody comes to clinic and says, gee, I'm only 60, but I'm having memory problems, and all my aunts and uncles seem to do this at this age.
Okay, it happened. I call you guys out. I noted that you're fascinating. And so suddenly we started getting some calls because we've gotten past that issue now. People are willing to deal. First is Bill in Timberville. Bill, thanks for calling in on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment, please, for Dr. Kathleen Fuchs, Sue Friedman, and or Eliezer Sobel.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. A simple question. I've heard, you know, a number of places over the years that drinking things out of aluminum cans has an effect in increasing your risk of Alzheimer's. So should I not worry? Is that just urban legend, or should I start buying my beer in bottles?
Well, I'll answer for the Alzheimer's Association. The aluminum scare is not based in science. I actually had someone tell me a month ago that they were going to quit using deodorant that had aluminum because they'll get Alzheimer's. And the science does not support the connection between Alzheimer's and aluminum. And Dr. Fuchs, would you
I'd agree with
expand?
That, yeah.
Yes. There's just no science there.
Bill, it's such a great question, though, because so many people have heard about that, not just from aluminum cans, but the whole scare about cooking in aluminum pans. Mm-hmm. So it's good to have a chance to set that to rest. Thank you so much for your call, sir. On the other side, coconut oil as a preventative? You want to talk about that?
Well, again, the science is not there to indicate that coconut oil can be a preventative, much like many will remember a few years ago. There was a 3,000-person study, a scientific random control group study on ginkgo, and ginkgo's purported benefits for memory and cognitive health. And that study showed absolutely no difference. Now, not to say that ginkgo hurts you, but we can't say that taking ginkgo will improve or in some way prevent your risk for Alzheimer's.
Eliezer Sobel, we're going to run out of time in a few minutes here, and I got to ask you about this because I know in addition to this beautiful book that you've published, you also do lots of public speaking about Alzheimer's and your family's experience. And one of the things that I understand, if I've got this right, that you talk about in public is what you call the hidden joys of Alzheimer's?
Yeah. My mother, I went to a psychic when she first started showing signs and said I was concerned. And the psychic said, I think your mother might be a lot happier without her memories. And being a Holocaust refugee with a lot of horror in her past, it turned out to be true. She became progressively more and more sweet, loving, kind, and open, which was not exactly the personality that I was familiar with. So she actually is a lot happier than I am. She has spent these years, for the most part, laughing most of the day, just finding every. She was lying in a hospital gurney about to get an endoscopy, and I said, "Hey, Mom, you're going to get an endoscopy," and she just cracked up like it was the funniest thing I ever said to her. And I just want to tell one quick anecdote. In terms of, you mentioned, Sue, meaningful activities. Mm-hmm. Well, there's also unmeaningful activities where, for example, my niece and my mother and I once spent 30 minutes playing tangerine poker, a game we were making up as we went along, where I would put a card down and move my tangerine next to the salt shaker. Then my niece would pick up the tangerine, peel it, and discard a four of clubs. Then my mother would start eating the tangerine, and we were laughing, and this went on 30 minutes. And my father, who was a professor of mathematics and very linear, was watching, completely perplexed, wanting to understand the rules to learn how to play this game.
But I think it's another great example of how you were able to be where she is. And so whereas you and I might look at that and say, that is really not a very meaningful game. In fact, it's a nonsensical game. It was meaningful for her.
Yeah.
And I think that's when we say meaningful activity, we don't mean meaningful activity for us.
Right.
And the greatest example I can come up with is we look at what people's past experiences and enjoyments had been. And one woman we worked with through the Connections program had been a house cleaner. And she particularly loved clean glass. She loved a mirror or a window that sparkled. So her greatest joy was taking the Windex and the paper towel that were positioned in the bathroom next to the mirror for an hour. Yeah. She would clean that mirror. Now, you and I might think that's almost abuse, but her enjoyment of that was so profound and so complete. That was a very meaningful activity for her.
Hey, Dr. Kathleen Fuchs at the University of Virginia Medical School. Just the first page of my list here has at least a dozen more questions that we're not going to get to, let alone all the other pages. So in this last minute and a half that we have, I'm just going to ask you, what haven't we touched on that you most would like to?
gosh, we really touched on the things that don't get said a lot, and that is about that sort of personally meaningful activities, the going to where a person is at, the not getting caught up in the, oh my gosh, I have to take this pill or this supplement or do this particular thing to stay healthy, but to look at it more in a holistic way of, I'm gonna enjoy things, I'm gonna stay active, I'm going to eat good foods because they taste good and they're good for me, and just really be kind of content and forward thinking with that, and also not to get caught up in the specifics. So I'll just say really quickly, a lot of people get very agitated that their family member doesn't know what day it is or some other specific thing. And we say, really, is it that important to that person right now? If it's life and safety, by all means, correct them. But otherwise, just go with it.
I know there's going to be a link to it on the WMRA Virginia Insight page. But before we go, Eliezer, mention, if you would, the website you want everybody to know about.
Thanks, Tom. Yeah, to learn more about the book and to order it through Amazon, you can just go to blueskywhiteclouds.com. blueskywhiteclouds.com. Thanks.
Our guests have been Sue Friedman, President and CEO of the Alzheimer's Association of Central and Western Virginia, Kathleen Fuchs, neuropsychologist and member of the Memory and Aging Care Division at the University of Virginia, as well as Eliezer Sobel, author of Blue Sky, White Clouds, a book for memory-challenged adults. Thank you all so very much for making time for us.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks, Tom.
Virginia Insight's executive producer is Matt Bingay. Our associate producers, Bob Levicky and Terry Ward. We had extra help today from Sarah McConnell, Elliot Majerzik, Tony Field, and Andrew Windham at the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Chespay and Inner Rhythm. Now, you can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org, then clicking on Programs, and then clicking on Virginia Insight. And when you go to that page, you will find links to more information about each of our guests and the work they are doing. Thank you so very much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.